He was trying to sound confident, but Jack could hear his doubt. The two men shared a long silence before Jack said, "Tell me the truth. What happened in that last hostage drama you were involved in?" The negotiator sighed. "The man released the hostages. But he shot himself before we managed to get in." Those words would follow Jack throughout the day, right next to his skin. He had started to walk back down the stairs by the time the negotiator cleared his throat.
"Okay, Jack, can I ask you a question? Why did you turn down that job in Stockholm?"
Jack considered lying, but couldn't summon up the energy. "How do you know about that?"
"I talked to one of the bosses before I set off, asked her who was on the scene locally. She said I should talk to Jack, because he's bloody good. She said she'd offered you a job several times, but that you keep turning it down."
"I've got a job."
"Not like the one she's offering."
Jack snorted defensively. "Oh, all you Stockholmers think the world revolves around your bloody city." The negotiator laughed.
"Listen, I grew up in a village where you had to drive 40 minutes if you wanted to buy milk. Back there, we used to think your town was metropolitan. To us, you were the Stockholmers."
"Everyone is someone else's Stockholmer, I guess."
"So what's your problem, then? Are you worried you wouldn't be able to cope with the job if you took it?"
Jack rubbed his hands on his pants. "Are you my psychologist or something?"
"Sounds like you could do with one."
"Can't we just focus on the job in hand?"
The negotiator hesitated and took a deep breath before asking, "Does your dad know you've been offered another job?"
Jack was about to swear, but the negotiator never got to hear what. Because at that moment, Jack looked out of the window in the stairwell and saw that his dad was no longer waiting in the street like he'd been told.
"What the hell?" Jack exclaimed.
Then he ended the call and ran. Chapter 53. Zara had just stepped out onto the balcony when Jack saw her. That was just after she had told the bank robber out in the hall not to do anything silly, and she needed fresh air more than ever. If all you saw was the rear view of Zara heading toward the balcony, you'd probably think she was impatient. You needed to see her face to understand that she was feeling fragile. She had surprised herself back there, had lost control, felt things. For anyone else, that might perhaps merely have been vaguely uncomfortable, like when you discover you're starting to share the same taste in music as your parents, or biting into something you think is chocolate but turns out to be liver pate. But for Zara, it unleashed a feeling of complete panic. Was she starting to develop a sense of empathy? She rubbed her hands carefully with sanitizer, counted the windows of the building on the other side of the street over and over again, tried to take deep breaths. She had been in the apartment too long. These people had shrunk her customary distance, and she wasn't used to that. Out on the balcony, she pressed herself up against the wall of the building so no one down in the street could see her over the railing. She clamped the headphones over her ears and turned the volume up until the shrieking noise of the music drowned out the shrieking noise inside her head, until the bass was thudding harder than her heart. And just there, perhaps she found it. A truce with herself. She could see winter making itself comfortable across the town. She liked the silence of this time of year, but had never appreciated its smugness. When the snow arrives, autumn has already done all the work, taking care of all the leaves and carefully sweeping summer away from people's memories. All winter had to do was roll in with a bit of freezing weather and take all the credit, like a man who spent 20 minutes next to a barbecue but has never served a full meal in his life. She didn't hear the balcony door open, but she felt a furry ear on her hair as Leonard stepped out and stood beside her. He tapped gently on one of the earphones.
"What?" she snapped. "Do you smoke?" Leonard asked.
Because even though he hadn't managed to remove the rabbit's head, there was a small hole in the snout that he was fairly certain he'd be able to smoke through.
"Certainly not," Zara said, putting the headphone back over her ear.
Leonard was surprised, even if that wasn't visible through the unchanging ambivalence of the rabbit's head. Zara looked like someone who smoked, not because she liked it so much as to make the air worse for other people. The rabbit tapped on the headphone again, and she removed it with the utmost reluctance.
"What are you doing out on the balcony, then?" he wondered.
Zara took a long, hard look at him, starting from his white socks, via his bare legs and his non-elasticated underpants, to his bare torso, where the chest hair had started to go gray.
"Do you really think you're in any position to question other people's life choices?" she asked, but didn't sound anywhere near as annoyed as she had hoped, which was annoying.
He scratched his big, lifeless rabbit's ears and replied,
"I don't smoke either, not really. Just at parties. And when I'm being held hostage."
He laughed. She didn't. He fell silent. She put the headphone back on her ear, but of course he tapped on it again immediately.
"Can I stand out here with you for a while? I'm worried Roger might hit me again if I go back in there."
Zara didn't answer, just put the headphone back in place, and the rabbit tapped on it at once.
"Are you here on safari, then?"
She glared at him in surprise.
"What does that mean?" "Just an observation. There's always someone like you at every apartment viewing. Someone who doesn't want the apartment, but is just curious. On safari. Test driving a lifestyle. You get to recognize that sort of thing in my job."
The look in Zara's eyes was poisonous, but her mouth remained closed. Being seen through isn't pleasant. You tend to pull your clothes a little tighter when it happens, especially if you're usually the one who sees through other people. Her instinct was to say something cruel to put a bit of distance between them, but instead she found herself asking, "Aren't you cold?" He shook his head and she had to duck to avoid one of his ears. Then he patted his furry face and chuckled,
"Nope. They say 70% of your body heat gets lost through your head, so seeing as I'm stuck in here, I suppose I'm only losing 30% right now."
That isn't the sort of thing a man dressed in tight underwear usually boasts about in freezing temperatures, Zara noted. She put the headphones back on again, hoping that would be enough to get rid of him. But even before he tapped on the headphone again, she had already guessed that his next sentence was going to start with the word I.
"I'm really an actor. This business of disrupting apartment viewings is only a sideline."
"How interesting," Zara said in a tone that only the child of a telesales operative would interpret as an invitation to go on talking.
"Times are tough for people in the cultural sector," the rabbit nodded.
Zara pulled the headphones down around her neck in resignation and snorted,
"So that's your excuse for exploiting the fact that times are tough for people selling apartments, too? How come you people in the cultural sector never think capitalism is any good except when you're the ones profiting from it?"
It just slipped out. She didn't really know why. Between his ears, she caught a glimpse of the bridge. The ears wavered thoughtfully in the December wind.
"Sorry, but you don't strike me as the sort of person who feels sorry for people trying to sell apartments," he said.
Zara snorted again, more angrily.
"I don't care about sellers or buyers, but I do care about the fact that you don't seem to appreciate that your sideline is manipulating the economic system."
The rabbit's head was stuck in a rictus grin while Leonard was thinking hard inside it. Then he said what Zara considered to be the stupidest thing that could ever come out of anyone's mouth, rabbit or human.
"What have I got to do with the economic system?"
Zara massaged her hands, counted the windows.
"The market is supposed to be self-regulating, but people like you spoil the balance between supply and demand," she said wearily.
Of course, the rabbit responded at once by saying the most predictable thing possible.
"That's not true. If I wasn't doing this, someone else would. I'm not breaking the law. An apartment is the largest investment most people make, and they want the best price, so I'm just offering a service that..."
"Apartments aren't supposed to be investments," Zara replied gloomily.
"What are they supposed to be, then?"
"Homes."
"Are you some sort of communist?"
the rabbit chuckled. Zara felt like punching him on the nose for that, but instead she pointed between his ears and said,
"When the financial crisis hit 10 years ago, a man jumped off that bridge because of a property market crash on the other side of the world. Innocent people lost their jobs and the guilty were given bonuses. You know why?"
"Now you're exaggerating."
"Because people like you don't care about the balance in the system."
Leonard chuckled superciliously inside the rabbit's head. He still hadn't realized who he'd embarked on a discussion with.
You need to calm down. The financial crisis was the bank's fault. I don't make the rules. Is that what you were about to say? You don't make the rules, you just play the game?
Zara interrupted wearily, seeing as she'd rather drink nitroglycerin and go on a trampoline than have to listen to yet another man lecturing her about financial responsibilities.
Yes. Well, no, but...
Zara had spent enough of her life in committee rooms with the target market for cufflinks to be able to predict the rest of this guy's monologue, so she decided to save her time and his larynx.
Let me guess where you're going with this. You don't care about the seller of this apartment. You don't care about Roger and Anna Lena either. You only care about yourself. But you're going to try to defend yourself by saying that it isn't possible to cheat the housing market, because the market doesn't really exist. It's a construct, just numbers on a computer screen. So you don't have any responsibility, do you?
No,
Leonard began, but didn't even manage to take a breath before Zara stormed on.
Then you'll dredge up some pop psychological nonsense about money not having any value, because that's also a construct. And then we get to the history lesson, where clever old you gets to teach silly, ignorant me about economic theory and how the stock market came about. Maybe you feel like telling me about Hanoi, 1902, when the city tried to fight a plague of rats by offering the inhabitants a reward for every rat they killed and whose tail they handed over to the police. And what did that lead to? People started breeding rats. Do you have any idea how many men have told me that story to illustrate how selfish and untrustworthy ordinary people are? Do you know how many men like you every single woman on the planet meets every day who think that every thought that pops into your tiny little male brains is a lovely present you can give us?
Leonard had backed away 3 steps toward the railing by this point, but Zara had got into her stride now, so all he had time to say was, before she snapped,
"You what? You what? You're not the greedy one. Everyone else is. Is that what you were about to say?"
The rabbit shook its ears.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't know anyone had jumped off that bridge. Did you know?
Zara's cheeks were throbbing. Her throat was bright red beneath the headphones. She was no longer talking to Leonard, but exactly who she was talking to probably wasn't clear even to her, but it felt like she'd been waiting 10 years to yell at someone. Anyone at all. Herself, most of all. So she roared,
"People like you and me are the problem, don't you get that? We always defend ourselves by saying we're only offering a service, that we're just one tiny part of the market, that everything is people's own fault, that they're greedy, that they shouldn't have given us their money. And then we have the nerve to wonder why stock markets crash and the city is full of rats."
Her eyes were wild with rage, and little clouds of smoke kept puffing breathlessly out of her nostrils. The rabbit didn't reply. Those unblinking eyes just looked at her as she tried to get her pulse under control. Then there was a hacking sound from inside the head, and at first Zara thought the old bastard was having a stroke, then realized that this was what Leonard sounded like when he was laughing, really properly, from deep in his stomach. He held his arms out.
"I don't know what you're talking about anymore, to be honest, but I give up. You win. You win."
Zara's eyes narrowed, from fear as much as anger. It was easier to talk to the rabbit than other people, because she didn't have to look Leonard in the eye. She wasn't prepared for what that was going to do to her. She leaned forward and stretched her fingers out on her thighs, bent and straightened them over and over again. Then she said in a quieter voice,
"I win, do I? Do Anna Lena and Roger win? He's trying to get rich and she's trying to make him happy, and all they're really doing is postponing an inevitable divorce. But that probably just makes you happy, because then they'll have to buy 2 apartments.
At that, something happened. Leonard raised his voice for the first time.
"No, that's not enough, because I don't believe that." "So what do you believe, then?"
Zara snapped back, and regardless of whatever it was that had led her to this point, her voice finally broke. She screwed her eyes shut and clenched her fists around the headphones. She had been waiting 10 years for someone to ask her that question. so it almost floored her when he said, "Love." Lennart picked up and dropped the word so carelessly, as if it weren't a big deal at all. Zara wasn't prepared for it, and that sort of thing can make a person angry. Lennart's voice became more muffled inside the rabbit's head, hurt now. "You're talking like I'd be happy if people got divorced. No one can go to 2,000 apartment viewings and not realize that there's more love in the world than the opposite." Not even Zara had an answer to that. And he still didn't seem to be freezing, the idiot in the rabbit's head, which just made her more annoyed. Stop talking about love and feel cold, for God's sake, like any normal idiot, she thought, and prepared to fire back with some devastating remark. But all she heard herself ask was, "What do you base that on?" The rabbit's ears quivered. "All the apartments that aren't for sale." Zara's fingers fumbled around her neck. It wasn't an entirely ridiculous answer, which obviously annoyed her. Why couldn't Lennart have the decency to be a complete idiot? An idiot who is also a romantic is almost unbearable, and that almost can drive a woman with headphones mad. So she remained silent, gazing off toward the bridge. Then she let out a resigned sigh and pulled two cigarettes out from her bag. She stuck one in the rabbit's snout and the other in her own mouth. The rabbit was smart enough not to start going on about her earlier claim that she didn't smoke. She appreciated that. When she gave him the lighter, he managed to singe the fur on his nose and had to pat the flames out with his hands. She appreciated that as well. They smoked without any sense of urgency. Then Lennart said, heavily but with no trace of accusation, as he looked out across the rooftops, "You can think what you like about me, but Annalena is one of the few clients I've got who I can't help rooting for. She doesn't want to make her husband rich, she just wants to make him feel needed. Everyone takes it for granted that she's submissive and oppressed and that she's always had to stand back and make sacrifices for his career. But do you know what job she used to do?" "No," Zara confessed. "She was a senior analyst for a big American industrial company. I didn't believe it at first because she's as scatty as a box of kittens. But you won't find a smarter, better educated person in this apartment, I can assure you of that. When their kids were young, his career started to take off, but hers was going even better. So Roger turned down a promotion so he could spend more time at home with the children, and she could go on all her business trips. It was only going to be for a few years, but her career started to go even better while his was treading water, and the more difference there was between their salaries, the harder it was for them to swap places. When the kids had grown up and Annalena had accomplished all her goals, she turned to Roger and said, 'Now it's your turn.' But he wasn't offered any more promotions. He'd got too old. They didn't have any way of talking about that because they'd never practiced the right words. So now she's trying to make it up to him by moving all the time and renovating apartments. Also, they have a project in common. Roger has no kids to look after anymore, so he feels worthless. And Annalena just wants a home. You can say a lot of things about me, but don't you dare insinuate that I'm not rooting for those two." Zara lit another cigarette, mostly so she could keep her eyes busy, staring at the glowing tip. "Did Annalena tell you all that?" "You'd be surprised what people tell me." "No, I wouldn't," Zara whispered. She felt like telling him that she needs distance, that she can't stop massaging her hands, that she counts everything in every room because it calms her down, that she likes spreadsheets and turnover forecasts because she likes order. But she also felt like telling him that the economic system she has devoted her life to working in is the world's biggest problem right now because we made the system too strong. We forgot how greedy we are, but above all, we forgot how weak we are. And now it's crushing us. She felt like saying all this, but by this point in her life, she had gotten used to the fact that people either didn't understand or didn't want to understand. So she stood there in silence. And, deep down, wished she'd stayed silent the whole time. They each smoked another cigarette. Zara objected to his presence less than she would have expected, and that day had already offered more new experiences than she felt ready to absorb. So her fingers immediately started to trace the edges of the headphones when the rabbit's ears wavered in her direction again. She could tell that he was trying to think of something to ask her to keep the conversation going. That was what annoyed Zara most about men, because they could only ever come up with two questions. What line of work are you in? And are you married? But this peculiar Leonard plucked up the courage to ask instead, "What are you listening to?"
Bloody hell, Zara thought. Why can't you just feel the cold and not be interested in me?
She opened her mouth. There was so much she wanted to say, but all that came out was, "The bank robber's going to give up soon. The police will come storming in any time now. You should go and put a pair of pants on." The rabbit nodded disappointedly. He left her with her headphones on, music at top volume, counting the windows over and over again. It may not be the sort of love story anyone would write poetry about, but they floored each other there and then. Chapter 54. Estelle knocked tentatively on the door to the closet. Julia opened it.
"I just wanted to let you know that the pizzas are on their way, but I was thinking that you must be starving, eating for two, you poor thing. Would you like something to eat while we're waiting? There's food in the freezer. I mean, people almost always have food in the freezer," Estelle offered.
"No, thanks. That's sweet of you, but I'm fine," Julia smiled. She liked the fact that Estelle was concerned. More people should do that. Ask if you're hungry instead of how you're feeling.
"Well, then, I won't disturb you," Estelle said and started to close the door.
"Would you like to come in?" Julia asked. But to be honest, she said it the way you do when you kind of hope the answer is going to be no.
"I'd love to,"
Estelle chirruped, then stepped in and closed the door behind her. She pushed past the stepladder and sat down on the last available seat in the closet, a chest tucked right at the back. She folded her hands on her lap, smiled warmly, and said,
"Well, this is all rather nice, really, isn't it? I haven't eaten pizza for years. Of course, I'd have to admit that this whole business of the bank robbery and hostage-taking hasn't been particularly pleasant for any of us, but I can't help thinking that it's quite encouraging that we've got a female bank robber, don't you think? It's good when us girls show what we are capable of."
Julia put her thumb on a specific point right between her eyes, pressed hard, and managed to control herself enough to reply,
"Threatening us with a pistol, but still, girl power."
"I don't think it's a real pistol," Annalena interjected quickly.
Julia closed her eyes so no one would see she was rolling them. Estelle smiled quizzically and asked,
"Well, I didn't mean to come in and interrupt you like this, like some silly old thing. What were you talking about?"
"Marriage,"
Annalena sniffed.
"Oh,"
Estelle exclaimed, as if her favorite category had just popped up on a television quiz show. Her enthusiasm softened Julia's attitude slightly, so she asked her,
"Did you say your husband's name is Knut? How long have you been married?"
Estelle counted in her head until she ran out of numbers.
"Knut and I have been married forever. It's like that when you get old. In the end, there simply wasn't ever a time before him."
Julia had to admit that she liked that answer.
"How do you manage to have such a long marriage?" she asked.
"You fight for it," Estelle replied honestly.
Julia didn't seem to like that quite as much.
"That doesn't sound very romantic."
Estelle grinned knowingly.
"You have to listen to each other all the time, but not all the time. If you listen to each other all the time, there's a risk that you can't forgive each other afterward."
Julia ran her fingernails unhappily across her eyebrows.
"Roe and I used to get along fine. We got along so well that it didn't matter that we were good at falling out, too. Sometimes I used to fall out with her on purpose because we were so good at the other bit. But now, oh, I don't know. I'm just not quite so sure about us anymore."
Estelle toyed with her wedding ring and moistened her lips thoughtfully.
"When we first fell in love, Knut and I reached an agreement about how we were allowed to argue, because Knut said that sooner or later the first flush of infatuation wears off and you end up arguing whether you like it or not. So we came to an agreement, like the Geneva Convention, where the rules of war were agreed. Knut and I promised that no matter how angry we got, we weren't allowed to consciously say things just to hurt each other. We weren't allowed to argue just for the sake of winning. Because sooner or later, that would end up with one of us winning. And no marriage can survive that.
Did it work? Julia asked.
I don't know, Estelle admitted.
No?
We never got past the first flush of infatuation.
There was no point even trying not to like her just then. Estelle looked around the closet for a while, as if she were trying to remember something. Then she stood up and lifted the lid of the chest.
What are you doing? Julia wondered.
Just having a look, Estelle said apologetically.
Annalena found this upsetting, because Annalena thought there were actually unwritten rules about how much snooping you were allowed to do at apartment viewings.
You can't do that. You're only allowed to look in cupboards if they're already open, except for kitchen cupboards. You're allowed to open kitchen cupboards, but only for a few seconds to see how big they are. But you're not allowed to touch the contents or make any judgments about their lifestyle. There are rules. You're allowed to open the dishwasher, but not the washing machine.
You might have been to a few too many apartment viewings, Julia said to her.
I know, Annalena sighed. There's wine in here, Estelle exclaimed happily, pulling two bottles out of the chest. And a corkscrew.
Wine?
Annalena repeated, suddenly delighted. So it was evidently okay to snoop inside chests if you found wine.
Would you like some? Estelle offered.
I'm pregnant, Julia pointed out.
Aren't you allowed to drink wine, then?
You're not allowed to drink any alcohol at all.
But wine?
Estelle's eyes were wide with benevolent intent.
Because wine is only grapes, after all. And children like grapes.
Wine, too,
Julia said patiently, and thought of how Roe had said, "All the time, I'm drinking for three now," when the midwife at the antenatal clinic asked a routine question about how much they drank. The midwife didn't realize Roe was joking, and the atmosphere became tense. Julia laughed as she thought about it now. That happens quite a lot when you're married to an idiot.
Have I done something wrong?
Estelle wondered anxiously, drinking straight from the bottle before passing it to Annalena, who didn't hesitate before taking two long swigs, which seemed highly out of character for Annalena. It was a strange day for all of them.
No, not at all. I was just thinking about something my wife did.
Julia smiled and tried to stop laughing with mixed results.
Julia's wife is an idiot, just like Roger,
Annalena explained helpfully to Estelle and drank another swig, this time larger than the space in her mouth, which prompted a fit of coughing through her nose. Julia leaned forward and patted Annalena on the back. Estelle helpfully took the bottle from her and made it a bit lighter in the meantime. Then she said quietly,
Knut isn't an idiot. He really isn't. But it's taking him an awfully long time to park the car. I wish he was here, so I just wasn't prepared to be held hostage on my own.
Julia smiled. You're not on your own. You've got us. And this bank robber doesn't seem to want to hurt anyone, so I'm sure everything's going to be all right. But can I ask you something?
Of course you can, sweetheart.
Did you know there was going to be wine in that chest? If you didn't, why did you decide to have a look?
Estelle blushed. After a long pause, she confessed,
I usually hide wine in the closet at home. Knut used to think that was silly. I mean, he thinks it's silly. But you assume people think the way you do yourself, so I was thinking that if the person living here was worried about people coming and seeing bottles of wine and thinking, well, this person's an alcoholic, then the closet would be the perfect place to hide the wine.
Annalena took another two gulps of wine, hiccuped loudly, and added,
Alcoholics don't have unopened bottles of wine in the house. They have empty wine bottles.
Estelle nodded at her gratefully and replied without thinking,
"That's kind of you to say. Canute would have agreed with you."
The old woman's eyes were glistening, not only from the wine. Julia frowned so hard and so thoughtfully that she got a whole new hairstyle. She leaned forward, put her hand gently on Estelle's arm, and whispered,
"Estelle, Canute isn't parking the car, is he?"
Estelle's thin lips disappeared sadly beneath each other, so the word barely reached past them when she eventually admitted,
"No."
Chapter 55. Witness interview, date December 30th. Name of witness, Leonard.
Let me see if I've got this right. You weren't at the viewing as a prospective buyer, but had been hired by Annalena to spoil it?
Exactly. No boundaries, Leonard. That's me. Would you like a business card? I do stag parties, too. If the guy getting married has stolen your girl, that sort of thing.
So that's your job? To ruin apartment viewings?
No, I'm an actor. There just aren't many roles around at the moment. But I was in The Merchant from Venice at the local theater.
Of Venice?
No, at the local theater here.
I meant that it's called The Merchant of Venice, not from Venice. Never mind. Can you tell me anything else about the bank robber?
I don't think so. I've told you everything I remember.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to stay a little longer in case we have any further questions.
No problem.
Oh, yes. One last thing. What do you know about the fireworks?
How do you mean?
The fireworks the perpetrator asked for.
What about them?
Well, when someone takes other people hostage, it isn't customary for the perpetrator to demand fireworks before letting them go. It's more normal to demand money.
With all due respect, it's more normal not to take anyone hostage in the first place.
That's as may be, but don't you think fireworks is an odd demand? That was the last thing the perpetrator did before you were released.
I don't know. It's New Year. And everyone likes fireworks, don't they?
Dog owners don't.
Ah.
What do you mean by that?
I was just surprised. I thought all police officers liked dogs.
I didn't say I didn't like dogs.
Most people would have said that dogs don't like fireworks, but you said dog owners.
I'm not particularly fond of animals.
Sorry, a peril of the profession. You learn to read people in my job.
As an actor?
No, the other. Are the others still here at the station, by the way?
Who?
You know, the others who were in the apartment.
Are you thinking of anyone in particular?
Zara, for instance.
For instance?
There's no need to look like I asked something improper. I mean, I'm only asking.
Yes, Zara's still here. Why do you ask?
Oh, I just wondered. You get curious about people sometimes, that's all. And she's the first person in a long time who I haven't been able to read at all. I tried, but I didn't get her at all. Why are you laughing?
I'm not laughing.
Yes, you are.
Sorry, I didn't mean to. Something my dad says, that's all.
What?
He says you end up marrying the one you don't understand. Then you spend the rest of your life trying.
Chapter 56.
Death, death, death,
Estelle thought in the closet. Many years ago, she had read that her favorite author used to start telephone conversations with that.
Death, death, death.
Then, when that was out of the way, they could discuss other things. Otherwise, after a certain age, no phone call ever seemed to be about life, only the other. Estelle could understand that point of view these days. The same author once wrote that you have to live your life in such a way that you become friends with death. But Estelle found that harder. She remembered when she used to read bedtime stories to the children, and Peter Pan declaring, "To die will be an awfully big adventure." Maybe for the person doing it, Estelle thought, but not for the one who was left behind. All that awaited her were 1,000 sunrises where life is a beautiful prison. Her cheeks quivered, reminding her that she had grown old. Her skin was so thin now that it moved the whole time in a breeze that nobody else could feel. She had nothing against old age, just loneliness. When she met Knut, it wasn't a love story, not the way she had read it could feel. Theirs was always more like a story of a child finding the perfect playmate. When Knut touched Estelle, right up to the end, it made her feel like climbing trees and jumping from jetties. Most of all, she missed making him laugh so hard he spat his breakfast out. That sort of thing only got more fun with age, especially after he got false teeth.
"Knut's dead," she said for the first time, and swallowed hard.
Julia was looking down at the floor in irresolute silence. Annalena sat and tried to think of something to say for a while, then leaned toward Estelle and tapped her on the shoulder with the wine bottle instead. Estelle took it and drank two small sips before handing it back and going on, half to herself.
"But he was very good at parking, Knut. He could parallel park in tiny spaces. So sometimes when it's most painful, when I see something really funny and think he'd have laughed so hard his breakfast would have covered the wallpaper, that's when I fantasize that he's just outside parking the car. He wasn't perfect, no man is, God knows. But whenever we went anywhere and it was raining, he would always drop me off just outside the door so I could wait in the warm while he parked the car."
A silence forced its way between the three women and gradually emptied their vocabularies until none of them knew what to say at all.
"Death, death, death," Estelle thought.
When Knut was lying in his sickbed those last nights, she asked him,
"Are you scared?"
He replied,
"Yes."
Then his fingers ran through her hair and he added, "But it'll be quite nice to get a bit of peace and quiet. You can put that on the headstone." Estelle laughed hard at that. When he left her, she wept so hard that she couldn't breathe. Her body was never really the same after that. She curled up and never quite unfurled again.
"He was my echo. Everything I do is quieter now," she said to the other women in the closet.
Annalena sat for a while before she opened her mouth, because, although she was starting to get drunk, she understood that it wouldn't be good form in the circumstances to appear greedy. They were wasted seconds, of course, because when she spoke the thought out loud, neither good intentions nor wild horses could hide the hopefulness in her voice.
"So, if your husband isn't parking the car, can I ask if it was true that you're looking at this apartment on behalf of your daughter, or was that..." "No, no. My daughter lives in a nice row house with her husband and children," Estelle replied sheepishly.
Just outside Stockholm, in fact, but Estelle didn't say that, because she didn't think this conversation needed to get any more complicated.
"So you're just here looking?" Annalena asked.
"Seriously, Annalena, she's not competing with you and Roger to buy the apartment. Stop being so insensitive," Julia snapped.
Annalena stared down into the bottle and mumbled,
"I was only asking."
Estelle patted them both gratefully on the arm, one at a time, and whispered,
"Now, don't fall out on my account, dears. I'm too old to be worth that."
Julia nodded sullenly and put her hand around her stomach. Annalena did the same with the wine bottle.
"How old are your grandchildren?" she asked.
"They're teenagers now," Estelle said.
"Oh, sorry to hear that," Annalena said with feeling.
Estelle smiled feebly. If you've lived with teenagers, you know they only exist for themselves, and their parents have their hands full dealing with the various horrors of life. Both the teenagers and their own. There was no place for Estelle there. She was mostly something of a nuisance. They were pleased that she answered the phone when they called on her birthday, but the rest of the time they assumed time stood still for her. She was a nice ornament that they only took out at Christmas and midsummer.
"No, I'm not here to buy the apartment. I just haven't got anything to do. Sometimes I go to apartment viewings out of curiosity to listen to people talking, hear what they're dreaming about. People's dreams are always at their grandest when they're looking for somewhere to live. Canute died slowly, you know. He lay in a care home for years. I couldn't start living as if he was dead, but he wasn't alive. Not really. So my life was on pause, somehow. I took the bus to the care home each day and sat with him. Read books. Out loud at first, then to myself at the end. That's how it goes. But it was something to do. And a person needs that. Annalena thought that, yes, that was how it was. People needed to have a project. Life goes so fast. Working life, anyway, she thought out loud, and looked very taken aback when she realized that Julia had heard her. What did you used to do? The young woman asked. Annalena filled her lungs, simultaneously hesitant and proud. I was an analyst for an industrial company. Well, I suppose I was the senior analyst, really, but I did my best not to be. Senior analyst? Julia repeated, instantly ashamed of how that sounded. Annalena saw the surprise in her eyes, but she was used to it and didn't take offense. Ordinarily, she would just have changed the subject, but perhaps the wine had the upper hand on this occasion, because instead she thought out loud, without any hesitation, yes, I was. Not that I wanted that. To be a boss, I mean. The president of the company said that was precisely why he wanted me to do it. He said you don't have to lead by telling other people what to do. You can lead by just letting them do what they're capable of instead. So I tried to be a teacher, more than a boss. I know people find it hard to believe of me, but I'm not a bad teacher. When I retired, two of my staff said they hadn't realized I was actually their boss until they heard the speech thanking me for my work. A lot of people would probably have taken that as an insult, but I thought it was nice. If you can do something for someone in such a way that they think they managed it all on their own, then you've done a good job. Julia smiled. You're full of surprises, Annalena. Annalena looked like that was the nicest compliment anyone had ever given her. Then sorrow and grief swept through her eyes again. She closed them quickly and opened them slowly. Everyone thinks I've... Well, when you meet us, people probably think I've always been in Roger's shadow. That really isn't the case. Roger should have had a chance to fulfill his potential. He had great potential. But my job... Things were going so well for me, better and better, so he turned down promotions so he could drop the kids off at nursery and all that. I got to travel and have my career, always thinking that it would be his turn next year. But that never happened. She fell silent. For once, Julia wasn't sure what to say. Estelle looked like she didn't know what to do with her hands, which resulted in her opening the chest and sticking them in there again. They came back out with a box of matches and a packet of cigarettes. Goodness, she exclaimed brightly. What sort of person lives here, really? Julia wondered. Would anyone like one? Estelle offered. I don't smoke, Annalena declared immediately. Nor me. Or rather, I've given up most of the time. Do you smoke? Estelle wondered, turning to Julia, then added quickly, Well, I don't suppose anyone does when they're pregnant. In my day, they used to. You used to cut back a bit, of course, but I'm assuming you don't smoke at all. No, not at all, Julia said patiently. Young people today, you're so aware of how you affect your children. I heard a pediatric doctor say on television that a generation ago, parents used to come to him and say, Our child's wetting the bed, what's wrong with him? Now, a generation later, they come to him and say, Our child's wetting the bed, what's wrong with us? You take the blame for everything. Julia leaned back against the wall. We probably make all the same mistakes that your generation did, just different versions of them. Estelle rolled the packet between her hands. I used to smoke on our balcony because Canute didn't like the smell when I smoked indoors. And I liked the view. We could see all the way to the bridge, just like from this apartment, really. I used to be very fond of that. But then, well, You might remember that a man jumped off that bridge 10 years ago. It was in all the papers. And I checked to see what time of day he jumped and realized it was right after I'd been out on the balcony smoking. Knut called to say something was happening on television, and I hurried back inside, leaving the cigarette to burn itself out in the ashtray, and in that time, the man had climbed up onto the railing and jumped. I stopped smoking on the balcony after that.
"Oh, Estelle, it wasn't your fault that someone jumped off a bridge," Julia said, trying to console her.
"It wasn't the bridge's fault either," Annalena added.
"What?"
"It isn't the bridge's fault if someone jumps off it. I remember it well, you know, because Roger found the whole thing very upsetting."
"Did he know the man who jumped?" Estelle asked.
"Oh, no, but he knew a lot about the bridge. Roger was an engineer, you see. He built bridges, not that particular bridge. But if you're as interested in bridges as Roger is, then you end up being interested in all bridges. They talked about that man on television as if it was the bridge's fault. Roger was very upset about that. Bridges exist to bring people closer together," he said.
Julia couldn't help thinking that was simultaneously a remarkably odd and a rather romantic thing to say. That was probably why, unless it was the fact that she was hungry and exhausted, she suddenly said, "My fiancé and I were in Australia a few years ago. She wanted to do a bungee jump off a bridge."
"Your fiancé? You mean Ro?" Estelle nodded.
"No, my previous fiancé."
It was a long story. All stories are, when it comes down to it, if you tell them from the start. This story, for instance, would have been considerably shorter if it had just been about three women in a closet. But of course, it's also about two police officers, and one of them was on his way up the stairs.
Chapter 57. What had happened out in the street was that Jack, before he went into the building opposite, had told his dad to wait there, and definitely not to go anywhere. More specifically, not into the building where the hostage drama was taking place. "Just wait here," the son said. But of course, the father didn't do that. He took the pizzas and went up to the apartment, and when he came back down, he had spoken to the bank robber. Chapter 58. Inside the closet, obviously Julia regretted mentioning her former fiancé as soon as she said it, so she added, "I was engaged when I met Ro, but that's a long story. Forget I mentioned it."
"We've got plenty of time for long stories," Estelle assured her, because she'd found another bottle of wine in the chest.
"Your fiancé wanted to jump off a bridge?" Annalena repeated in alarm.
"Yes, a bungee jump, with a rubber rope tied around your feet."
"That sounds mad."
Julia's fingertips massaged her temples. "I didn't like the idea either, but she was always wanting to do things, experience everything. It was on that trip that I realized I couldn't live with her, because I haven't got the energy to keep experiencing things the whole time. I started longing for everyday life, all the boring stuff, but she hated being bored. So I came back from Australia a week before her, blaming the fact that I had to work. And that was when I kissed Ro for the first time." Julia started to giggle as she said that, partly out of shame, but possibly also because it was the first time in ages that she'd thought about how they fell in love. You tend to forget that when you're in the middle of the life that follows. When you're going to become a parent with someone, it suddenly feels impossible to remember that you ever loved anyone else.
"How did you meet, you and Ro?" Estelle asked, wine staining the corners of her mouth.
"The first time? She came into my shop. I'm a florist, and she wanted some tulips. That was several months before I went to Australia. I didn't think much about it. She was attractive, of course. Anyone can see that."
Estelle nodded eagerly.
"Yes, that was the first thing I thought. She really is extremely beautiful and so exotic."
Julia sighed. "Exotic? because her hair is a different color to yours and mine? Estelle looked unhappy.
Aren't you allowed to say that anymore?
Julia didn't know how to begin to explain that her wife wasn't a piece of fruit, so instead she took a deep breath and carried on. Either way, she was attractive. Very attractive. Even more attractive than she is now. Not that... Don't tell her that, whatever you do. She's still attractive. But I'd certainly have liked to, you know, with her. But I was already taken. But she kept coming back to buy tulips. Several times a week, sometimes. And she made me laugh, out loud, out of nowhere. And you don't meet many people like that. I happened to mention that to my mom, and she said, "You can't live long with the ones who are only beautiful, Jules. But the funny ones, oh, they last a lifetime."
"Your mom's a wise woman," Estelle said.
"Yes."
"Is she retired?"
"Yes."
"What did she used to do?"
"She cleaned offices."
"What did your dad do?"
"He hit women." Estelle looked paralyzed, Anna Lena appalled. Julia looked at the pair of them and thought about her mom, and how the most beautiful thing about her was the fact that she always stared life right in the eye, and no matter what it threw at her, refused to stop being a romantic. That takes the sort of heart that hardly anyone possesses.
"Poor dear child," Estelle whispered. "What a bastard," Anna Lena muttered.
Julia shrugged, the way children who grew up too soon do, shaking the feelings off. "We walked out on him. He didn't come looking for us. I didn't even hate him, because Mom didn't let me. After everything he'd done to her, she wouldn't even let me hate him. I always wanted her to meet someone new, someone who was kind and made her laugh, but she always said I was enough. But then, when I told her about Roe, Mom saw something in me that made me see something in her. That probably sounds... I don't know how to explain it. Something she'd experienced once and given up all hope of, if you get what I mean. And I thought, is this how it feels? That thing everyone talks about? The real thing?" Anna Lena wiped some wine from her chin.
"So what happened?"
Julia blinked, first quickly, then slowly.
"My fiancé was still in Australia, and Ro came into the shop. I'd spoken to Mom on the phone that morning, and she just laughed when I said I didn't know how Ro felt, or even if she felt anything at all. Mom just said, 'Listen, no one likes tulips that much, Jules.' I suppose I tried to deny it, but Mom said I was practically being unfaithful already because I was spending so much time thinking about her. She said Ro was my flower shop. And I cried. So I was standing there in the shop, and Ro came in, and I laughed so hard at something she said that I accidentally spat on her face. She was laughing, too. So I guess she plucked up the courage, because I couldn't do it, and asked if I'd like to go for a drink with her. I said yes, but I was so nervous when we got there that I got really drunk. I went outside to smoke, got into a row with a security guard, and wasn't let back in. So I pointed through the window at Ro, who was standing at the bar, and said she was my girlfriend. The guard went in and told her that, and then she came out, and then she was. I called my fiancé and broke off the engagement. She's probably been having loads of fun ever since. And I love being boring with Ro. Does that sound mad? I love arguing with her about sofas and pets. She's my everyday. The whole world."
"I like the everyday," Anna Lena admitted. "Your mom was right. The ones who make you laugh last a lifetime," Estelle repeated,
thinking of a British author who had written that nothing in the world is so irresistibly contagious as laughter and good humor. Then she thought about an American author who had written that loneliness is like starvation. You don't realize how hungry you are until you begin to eat. Julia was thinking about how her mom, when she told her she was pregnant, looked first at Julia's stomach, then at Ro's, then asked, "How did you decide which of you was going to get knocked up?"
Julia got annoyed, of course, and replied sarcastically, "We played rock, paper, scissors, Mom." Her mom looked at them both again with deadly seriousness and asked, "So who won?" That still made Julia laugh. She said to the women in the closet, "Ro's going to be a brilliant mom. She can make any child laugh, just like my mom, because their sense of humor hasn't developed at all since they were 9.
"You're going to be a brilliant mom, too," Estelle assured her.
The bags under Julia's eyes moved softly as she blinked.
"I don't know. Everything feels such a big deal, and other parents all seem so funny the whole time. They laugh and joke, and everyone says you should play with children, and I don't like playing. I didn't like it even when I was a child. So I'm worried the child's going to be disappointed. Everyone said it would be different when I got pregnant, but I don't actually like all children. I thought that would change, but I meet my friends' children now, and I still think they're annoying and have a lousy sense of humor."
Annalena spoke up, briefly and to the point.
"You don't have to like all children, just one. And children don't need the world's best parents, just their own parents. To be perfectly honest with you, what they need most of the time is a chauffeur."
"Thanks for saying that," Julia replied honestly. "I'm just worried my child isn't going to be happy, that it's going to inherit all my anxiety and uncertainty."
Estelle gently patted Julia's hair.
"Your child's going to be absolutely fine, you'll see. And absolutely fine can cover any number of peculiarities."
"That's encouraging," Julia smiled.
Estelle went on patting her hair softly.
"Are you going to do all you can, Julia? Are you going to protect the child with your life? Are you going to sing to it and read it stories and promise that everything will feel better tomorrow?"
"Yes."
"Are you going to raise it so that it doesn't grow up to be one of those idiots who don't take their backpack off when they're on public transport?"
"I'll do what I can," Julia promised.
Estelle was thinking about another author now, one who almost 100 years ago wrote that your children aren't your children. They're the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself.
"You're going to be fine. You don't have to love being a mother, not all the time."
Annalena interjected.
"I didn't like the poo, I really didn't. At first it was okay, but when children are around 1 year old, they're like Labradors. Fully grown ones, I mean, not puppies, but..."
"Okay," Julia nodded to get her to stop.
"There's something about the consistency at a certain age. It gets like glue, sticks under your fingernails, and if you rub your face on the way to work..."
"Thanks, that's enough,"
Julia assured her, but Annalena couldn't stop herself.
"The worst thing is when they bring friends home and suddenly there's a 5-year-old stranger sitting on your toilet demanding to be cleaned up. I mean, you can put up with your own kids' poo, but other people's..."
"Thanks,"
Julia said emphatically. Annalena pursed her lips. Estelle giggled.
"You're going to be a good mom. And you're a good wife," Estelle added,
even though Julia hadn't even mentioned that last anxiety. Julia was holding the palms of her hands around her stomach and stared down at her fingernails.
"Do you think? Sometimes it feels like all I ever do is nag Ro, even though I love her."
Estelle smiled.
"She knows. Believe me. Does she still make you laugh?"
"Yes, God, yes."
"Then she knows."
"You have no idea. I mean, wow, she makes me laugh all the time. The first time Ro and I were about to, you know..."
Julia smiled, but stopped when she couldn't think of a word for what she was sure neither of the 2 older women would actually be horrified to hear.
"What?"
Annalena wondered uncomprehendingly. Estelle nudged her in the side and winked.
"You know, the first time they were going to go to Stockholm."
"Oh,"
Annalena exclaimed, and blushed from her head to her feet. But Julia didn't quite seem to hear. Her eyes lost their footing. There was a joke there somewhere in her memory, one Ro had made in the taxi that first time that Julia had intended to talk about. But instead, she found herself stumbling over the words.
I It's so silly, I'd forgotten this. I'd done some laundry, and there were some white sheets hanging over the bedroom door to dry. And when Ro opened the door and they hit her in the face, she started. She tried not to let it show, but I felt her flinch. So I asked what the matter was, and at first she didn't want to say, because she didn't want to burden me with anything, not as early as that. She was worried I'd break up with her before we'd even got together. But I kept on nagging, of course, because I'm good at nagging, and in the end, we sat up all night, and Ro told me about how her family got to Sweden. They fled across the mountains in the middle of winter, and the children each had to carry a sheet. And if they heard the sound of helicopters, they were supposed to lie down in the snow with the sheet over them, so they couldn't be seen. And their parents would run in different directions, so that if the men in the helicopter started firing, they'd fire at the moving targets, and not at... And I didn't know what to... She cracked, like thin ice on a puddle of water. First, just some hairline wrinkles around her eyes, then the rest, all at once. The collar of her top turned a darker color. She was thinking about everything Ro had told her that night, the incomprehensible cruelties that terrible people are capable of inflicting on each other, and the utter insanity of war. Then she thought of how Ro, after all that, had somehow managed to grow up to be the sort of person who made other people laugh. Because her parents had taught her during their flight through the mountains that humor is the soul's last line of defense. And as long as we're laughing, we're alive. So bad puns and fart jokes were their way of expressing their defiance against despair. Ro told Julia all this that first night. And after that, Julia got to spend all of the world's every days with her. Something like that can make you put up with living with birds.
An affair that started in a flower shop.
Estelle nodded slowly.
I like that.
She sat silent for several minutes. Then it burst out of her.
I had an affair once. Canute never knew.
Dear Lord, Anna-Lena exclaimed, now sensing that this was starting to get out of hand after all.
Yes, it wasn't all that long ago, you know,
Estelle grinned.
Who was it?
Julia asked.
A neighbor in our building. He read a lot, like me. Canute never read. He used to say authors were like musicians who never get to the point. But this other man, the neighbor, he always had a book tucked under his arm when we met in the elevator. So did I. One day he offered me his book, saying, I finished this one, I think you should read it. And so we started to swap books. He read such wonderful things. I don't have the words to describe it, but it was like going on a journey with someone. Where didn't matter. To outer space. It went on for a long time. I started to fold down the corners of pages when there was a bit I really liked, and he started to write little comments in the margins. Just the odd word. Beautiful. True. That's the power of literature, you know. It can act like little love letters between people who can only explain their feelings by pointing at other people's. One summer, I opened a book, and sand trickled out of it. And I knew he'd liked it so much he hadn't been able to put it down. Every now and then, I would get a book where some of the pages were crumpled, and I knew he'd been crying. One day, I told him that in the elevator. And he replied that I was the only person who knew that about him. And that was when you...
Julia nodded with a naughty smile.
Oh, no, no, no,
Estelle squeaked, and looked like she might have liked to finish the sentence by saying that she might possibly have wished it had happened, but of course that didn't change anything.
We were never, it never, I could never.
Why not? Julia asked. Estelle smiled, proud and full of longing at the same time. It takes a certain age for that, a certain life.
Because you dance with the person you went to the party with. And I went with Canute. So, what happened?
Anna-Lena wondered. Estelle's breathing didn't show any sign of speeding up. She didn't have many big secrets left. After this one, possibly none at all.
One day in the elevator, he gave me a book, and inside it was a key to his apartment. He said he didn't have any family living nearby and that he wanted someone in the building to have a spare key in case anything happened. I didn't say anything, and I didn't do anything, but I got the sense that maybe he would have liked it if something had happened.
She smiled. So did Julia.
So in all that time, you never... No. We exchanged books until he died a few years later. Something to do with his heart. His siblings put the apartment up for sale, but his furniture was still there at the viewing. So I went along, pretending to be interested in buying it. I walked around in his home, ran my hands over his kitchen counter, the hangers in his closet. In the end, I found myself standing in front of his bookcase. It's such an odd thing, the way you can know someone so perfectly through what they read. We liked the same voices in the same way.